Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So why do you want to learn a new language? I'll tell you why. Because ¿dónde está el baño? Can be a very important question at times. You know, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. Fast track your language acquisition with immersive lessons designed to teach you to pick up languages in a natural way. I love the fact that I can go from my laptop to my phone to pretty much anywhere and learn the language of my choice. Not to mention, I'm bringing my communication skills to new heights. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, StarTalk Radio listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/StarTalk. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/StarTalk today.
Welcome to Star Talk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. Star Talk begins right now. This is Star Talk. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, your personal astrophysicist. And today we have a very special guest. Not just a special guest, a very special guest. Returning to Star Talk, we have William Shatner, the one and only, a beloved actor, portrayed Captain Kirk on the Starship Enterprise in the original Star Trek series and movies that followed it some years later. And he's of special interest right now because he was on board the suborbital flight of Blue Origin's New Shepard space capsule. This is a 10-minute journey where you go across the Kármán line. That's the line where you enter space. And he was the oldest person to ever do this at age 90. Let's get straight into this. So, William Shatner, can I call you Bill? Does that work?
Yes, if I can call you Neil.
Yeah, please, please. Yeah, by all means. So you start out life as wanting to be an actor.
Yeah. I must have emerged from my mother's womb not knowing what to do. But
okay.
At the time I was sick.
Given time and food and nourishment.
Exactly. After suckling a bit, I thought, yes, I should be an actor. I was about 6 years of age when I was in a camp play, and as the legend goes, and I made people laugh and cry, and I thought, wow, that's wonderful. And I've never done anything else.
So I was channel surfing one night, and I stumbled on you in a bit role in the movie Judgment at Nuremberg. You were like a court clerk.
Court jester, according to some people, right.
Court jester.
No, but it's true. I sat there the whole movie at that legal table watching these incredible luminaries from the screen pass by and do a day's work and then leave and come back. It was an extraordinary experience for a young actor.
And there I am binging, because on classic and all the old episodes of The Twilight Zone, and you're two episodes. You've got a double credit in distinct episodes.
Yeah, and they are among the most popular, strangely. The reason for that, I don't know. Your sagacity, you would be able to analyze why those two shows have remained in the top 13 every time they play a group of them. I don't understand the popularity, but it must have something to do with touching some core of humanity.
You play a slightly crazy person in each one, just only slightly, just enough where the viewer can relate to your anxieties.
Being anxious about something, like in one case, flying. We're always anxious about flying. And And the other one was about getting your fortune told. And we're always worried about what the future holds and why did I say that for something in the past. So we're always concerned about those two subjects.
Yeah, so for that reason, I think, as you correctly deduced, it reached into us as viewers in a way that, while you were a slightly extreme version of it, we felt enough of ourselves in your character to relate to it more deeply than I think other characters portrayed or written for. So I just want to make sure that your acting chops are out there up front, because to take this ramp into space, initially, of course, with Star Trek, ultimately doing it for real. Did you have any space influences when you were a kid? You were already fully grown up during the Apollo era, so we can't credit that.
Space wasn't mentioned. You know, all those years ago, there was the sun, there was the moon, and people were running around trying to figure out how they hung in the sky. I was after, you know, I was after Galileo.
Oh, you did? Okay.
You
and Galileo weren't tight? You weren't tight
with
Galileo?
No, we weren't quite like that. We were like that, actually. there wasn't anything about, nothing about space and nothing. I was always interested in football and I was acting in Montreal doing amateur theatricals, and I somehow, I don't know what it was. I think there's something in my genetic makeup that allowed me to be an intuitive actor. I've never studied, I don't know how you study to be an actor, but there are styles, and I just fell into those styles. I may have seen them in movies, maybe I was imitating them, but there is a regality to Shakespeare. There is a effeteness to 18th century, 19th century comedy. There are styles that you sort of acquire, the way you speak, the way you move your hands, your feet. I never studied it, but somehow I knew it, and I don't know how.
Well, so what's happening then is the world, you know, we enter the Cold War, there's an arms race, and there's also the birth of a space race. And there's a poignant part of Shatner in Space, which is just now posting on Amazon Prime. If you have a video subscription there, I think it's quote free. In that program, there's a poignant moment where the Star Trek series, which went three seasons, all right, you know, just barely longer than Gilligan's Island, whatever. Okay. And it ends, you're out of a job, you and your wife divorce, and there you were putting a vision of space into our hearts and minds, and now that's gone, yet you witness Neil Armstrong taking first steps on the moon. Could you just tell us about what you were feeling in that moment, the contrast of these two?
Yeah, well, I got a divorce just as the show was canceled, and I don't know whether you know this or not, Neil, but divorces are very expensive.
Okay.
So there I was. I had this divorce. I was now broke, and I was coming off a series, which in those days meant that the people who hire think, oh, no, well, he's known for that, and we won't hire him for this because he's known for that. That sort of thinking went on for a while. And I was in that thinking. So it was difficult for me to find a really good acting job. And so I decided I would do summer stock. And the summer stock is out on the East Coast, on the Cape Cod. And so I don't remember whether I bought a truck or whether I had an old truck. And I put a cab on the back of that pickup truck, and it had a shower and a bed, and I had a dog. I've always had a dog, a Doberman Pinscher. So there was a book out in those years called Travel with Charlie.
I remember that. Yeah, John Steinbeck.
So I did Travels with Charlie, only my dog, I don't remember his name, but a regal, marvelous male Doberman sat beside me. And I drove across country and put together a play and did summer stock. And part of that summer stock goes on to Long Island and the Hamptons.
Wait, just to be clear, you were homeless at this point, okay?
No, I had a home that was in the back of a truck.
Yeah, your home was on wheels.
Like,
yes.
If a guy sleeps in his car, is he homeless or has he got a Chevy? I live. I have my address is Chevy.
on Interstate 10, exit 20.
The Ford truck. I got the Chevy truck. I think I had a Chevy. So
that's back when cars were big enough. You could sleep full out, flat out on the bench seating. Right?
Exactly. Right. So the philosophical question is, are you homeless if you're in something you own in your car? You're not sleeping on the streets. So I had a little tiny house here, which I didn't pay for. So I slept in the back of this truck.
And you said you ended up from Cape Cod into the Hamptons. Is that right?
I'm in Cape Cod, and I park in a pasture, and I'm living there, and I go and I drive over to the theater a mile or so away, perform at night. And then that night, I drive to the pasture and park and sleep in the cab. So it was this evening that I was sitting in a chair in the cab, or lying down in the chair, and I'm looking through the window at the moon, and I've got a little black and white TV set, and I'm tuned in to Armstrong on the Moon. And I had been at the Cape the year before and had some wonderful exchanges. I lay down in the lem. I looked around. The astronauts took me around. They gave me a ship a model of the Enterprise, and I signed it. I'll see you on the moon. And I was like a junior astronaut. And everyone said, "Oh, thank you very much." And they laughed. And then I left. And a year later, I'm looking at Armstrong putting his foot on the moon. And we had discovered, or either then or a little bit later, that as our ratings in Star Trek went up, the government voted more money for NASA. That became more popular. We popularized, Star Trek popularized space travel. And so I felt in some tiny, minuscule way, I had a little something to do with that. Mm-hmm. And there he puts, and the world is watching, and I'm lying bereft, moneyless, homeless in my Chevy, looking at him go on the moon. And the irony of that incredible moment and my destitution struck me even then. And upon retelling, I'm able to make it even more dramatic.
So Bill, here's my analysis. I think what happens is, once we're going to the moon, we don't need you, right? Because all of a sudden, space exploration is real. It's no longer pretend. And then, 3 years later, only 3 years, 1969, boots on the moon, 1972, no longer boots on the moon, we stop going into space. And here's my analysis. I think we all say to ourselves, wait a minute, that's not, wait a minute, this is supposed to keep going. And it didn't. It didn't. Even the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, 1968, that was imagining 2001. Wait a minute, this all stopped. Well, what do we have left? We got to go back to Star Trek. Star Trek was that hope. And so your popularity grew in reruns. Bigger than it ever was during the show.
Much bigger. Star Trek took off in reruns.
And into the 70s.
7 years later.
After we stopped going to the moon. So you, dude, became our only hope at that point.
I know. You were betting the wrong horse. You had your money on the wrong guy.
So I think... the fact that we became more distant from space made Star Trek that much more important and relevant to us. That's my, what do you think of that
analysis? Well, I think it's beautiful, and I heartily agree with you that I alone brought the NASA redid itself because of me. No. What happened is the expense of going to the moon. Kennedy saying, we're going to go to the moon in a decade, and American pride made us do it. Once we had done it, it was like, oh God, we're not going to spend any more money on that. We got, you know, we got the politicians' pockets to line, and all the money is gone. So they, because of the expense, and I don't know what happened, but it was like the air went out of American determination in space. We lost it for a while. I don't know whether this is apocryphal or not, but my understanding is Yuri Gagarin, and for your audience to remind them, he was the Russian astronaut who made the first launch into space, came down like a stone in a parachute. He was up there for a brief moment, and apparently he said, "It's blue," and then parachuted down. Now, we see the sky as blue, and we say, oh, that's blue, but knowledgeable people know that's refraction of the sun. The air is colorless, but whatever it is, the water, the moisture in the air gives us the blue color. And so we think, okay, well, but it's colorless, just blue because of the refraction of the sun. He gets above it, and he says, it's blue. And I thought, when I heard that story, I thought, what a glorious moment when the first human being looks down upon our planet and says, it's blue. And what a color. I mean, blue is a beautiful color. It's so engaging. It's so calming. I mean, you paint a room blue because you want the color to be restful.
Air Force One is painted blue, in part for that reason. Yeah. It's a very calming color for that.
I have gone across this continent many times, uncountable times, in every manner possible. When I was a kid, I thumbed across the United States. I left Montreal, got to San Diego, went to Vancouver, got to Chicago, back to Montreal on my thumb. I've motorcycled across the continent. I've driven a truck. I've in a sports car. I've been with a family. I've been alone. I mean, it's endless, Neil. The continent is endless. The roads go disappear into infinity. And you think, I'm good. Oh, my Lord, I have to go. And then you get to that infinite point of infinity, and it goes even further. It's not. It's then, by rising above it and looking down, oh, my God. It's minute. The earth is minute. And only then do you begin to get a sense of the relationship of this little rock to the vastness of space.
Bill, we got to take our first break, but when we return, more of my conversation with the inimitable, or occasionally imitable, William Shatner.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
I'm Joel Cherico, and I make pottery. You can see my pottery on my website, cosmicmugs.com. Cosmic Mugs, art that lets you taste the universe every day. And I support Star Talk on Patreon. This is Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
We're back with William Shatner. So you, I think, are correctly recognizing that Yuri Gagarin sees Earth as a blue planet. Okay. By the way, even in Star Trek, images of Earth were not really about it feeling blue. That really took actual journeys into space. And so are you ever thinking while you're starship captain that you'll ever actually be high up above Earth and see the blue planet?
That's fantasy. The whole thing was fantasy. Sometimes we'd laugh about how fantastical we were on stage 27 at Paramount Studios, pretending to be we're in space, and we move the rocks around. Now we're on a planet, and we shoot this gun, and later they put a little light thing in, and it's all fantasy. It's all beautiful fantasy about human beings somewhere in the future, but it's all, you know, it's these crazy guys who are thinking futuristically. Never thought, I'm going to go up there.
Well, just to be clear, Star Trek wasn't, at least for me, and I think for practically anyone who observed it, was not just space fantasy. There were space movies and space, you know, there was Lost in Space was a TV show, but that didn't somehow get deep within our soul. Star Trek had messages within it. There were morality tales.
The surroundings were fanciful. But the meanings, the reason it's popular, I think, is just what you're saying, that it dealt with human beings. But I meant the surroundings were fanciful. If you're talking about racism and a guy is half black on the right and half white on the left, and he meets a guy who's half black on the left and half white on the right, he's like, who are you? And we're fighting and because you're different from me. And so the stupidity, the nonsensical stupidity of racism is evident by these two guys who are fighting over the fact that one's different from the other, slightly.
But the value of telling a space tale is you get to present that to people without them being confronted in their behavior. They have to sort of internalize it and then realize it for themselves rather than
work. Exactly. Think of how that would work. The guy's like, oh, geez, what's he complaining about? It's got the black here and the white here and the brown here. Some guy who may be prejudiced in any way is laughing at the stupidity of this guy.
Yes.
You know, and he doesn't realize he's laughing at the stupidity of racism until later. He's if at some point in time, black, white, what's the difference? So that was the beauty of Star Trek.
Yeah. And it meant more than just
a tale told in space. And by the way, just if I can fanboy a little bit here, anytime I'm asked, okay, Kirk or Picard, this is like they quiz you that when you enter Comic-Con, right? Kirk or Picard? I'm Kirk all the time. And let me tell you why.
Me too.
Because
me too.
You too. No, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because your character actually, not that I'm a very nonviolent person, so let me start with that, but let me just say, your character would fight the bad guys. If you see your captain actually getting into a fist fight, oh my gosh, they're invested in this. They care about what is true and righteous on a level where they're putting their own lives at risk. You fought the Gorn. You did, not some pawn that you sent out to do so. And so I thought that level of bravery for a captain I greatly valued. And my favorite line, and I forgive me, the Star Trek fans, for not knowing the exact details. Your character is on the bridge. Your shields don't work anymore. The enemy vessel is out front. And you execute some command that's mysterious on a channel that's already been decoded. And Spock says, Captain, this is no time for a game of chess. And that command was a self-destruct command that would also destroy the enemy ship. Captain, there's no time for a game of chess. And you said, no, Spock, it's poker. And I said, yes, that's what, that's my captain. Oh, my gosh.
I've totally forgotten that. And it's a great line. Can you imagine the wonderful writer who wrote that thing?
Best line ever, especially because Spock, you said, you know, Spock is right here. And then you say, no, you are more right because, you know, you're bluffing and they don't know it. Oh my God. Yeah. So you got, I'm on the team Captain Kirk the whole way. So now you get tapped by Jeff Bezos and,
about 2 years before that, about 3 years now, Jason Ehrlich, a friend of mine who was a producer on another series I did, said, you know, you should go up in the middle. No, I'm not going to go up there. They don't want, who cares? And I don't want to jeopardize. Nah. He says, but it'd be, no. Anyway, the idea suggested, they say, come up to Seattle. We fly up to Seattle. I meet Jeff. The whole lobby of Amazon is all Star Trek. We sit down at the table. Shatner up in space. That sounds good. We'll let you know. And we go back. Then COVID hits and nothing happens. Then we hear that Jeff Bezos is going to go up in space himself. So we think, well, maybe he'll choose Shatner. No, he chooses his brother and a lady with gray hair and a boy, and they go up. I said, well, let's see what happens. Well, maybe they'd like you to go on a second, but no, I don't want to go up second, for God's sakes. That's the vice president. We want the president. So then they asked me to go up on the second one. No, I'm not going. So I turn it down. But then you might have an explanation for it. The wonderful moment between sleep and wake, when you're lying there thinking, you know, and your brain is going and you've got all kinds of wonderful ideas, which you forget when you get up. I'm thinking, you know, going up to space, it's an experience. I should try and experience that. As fearful as it sounds, so I agree to do it, thinking it's innocuous. I just go up, come down, who cares? And I've had that experience. Who knew that it would be as newsworthy as it was? I didn't. I thought it would be unknown.
Well, let me just say that you can't just send up any famous actor and have the same reaction as sending you. There's no question about this. So in the Shatner in Space documentary, he's got all this footage in anticipation of you going into space and some really fun encounter with you and your wife and daughters where you announce to them that, and they say, Dad, are you going to die? We don't want to lose a dad on this. And of course, if you died, you'd go out completely in flames, but in space. And
what a glorious ending it would be, rather than lose your teeth slowly, one by one, you lose them. And finally you're going, yeah, no, I play Captain Kirk, you know.
Toothless Captain Kirk. So, and of course, no, there's no reason to have pre-footage of just any random famous person who's about to go suborbital. It's not interesting. We need someone with space legacy who sat at the fulcrum of people's hopes and dreams of space, and that was you. So I'm delighted that such a documentary could be made with that footage, and we see this side of you. I mean, I was delighted by that. I was worried because you guys had to walk up to the capsule, up all those damn steps.
Wait, they don't have
a cherry picker or something to carry you up. I mean, dude, you're 90 years old.
I'm telling you, they asked me to come a day early. It's hysterical that you should come upon that point. So what do I, I'll go there, and then maybe Mr. Bezos will be there, and I'll have a chance to talk to him. And he wasn't. And there's the gantry. Let's go to the gantry and see what the gantry is. Okay, let's go and see what the gantry is. Let's walk up the gantry. Okay, 11 flights at 4,000 altitude. And I'm going up, and I'm going, and look how pretty. I stop at some landing. It's really pretty. And then another 3 flights. And I finally get to the top, but I made it. And I now, looking back, I got to assume somebody said, Jesus, do you think he'll make it up the gantry? He's 90 years old. Let's check him out. I now know it. That was a checkout. Imagine if I had failed. What would they do? No. Oh, sorry.
You've only made we lost Shatner on the fourth step.
On the night four. Oh, Lord. I'm telling you, that was, when I look back on that, I have to laugh. What if I hadn't made it? And everybody was behind me. I was walking up, and there'd be like 7 people behind me, scampering up. They're 20 years old. Hey, let's go. And I go, yeah, we'll go. I used to be able to scramble up, Neil. You may not believe it. I used to be able to run up 11 flights. Neil, how old are you?
I am right now 63.
Do you feel any of your strength leaving you? Like, can you open a bottle top as easily as you did before?
No, but I take kindly the counsel of the years, gracefully surrendering the things of youth.
So do you hand the bottle over
to my son?
Would you mind opening the bottle for me?
I've got tools.
I'm saying, would you mind getting this bag up the upper when they're flying? Okay, I need some help, and the bag is heavy.
I've got tools. I got tools now. I got tools. So I'm good with that. I was saying, so there's some shots of you inside the capsule before and during and after. And there's one of them when you're weightless. I don't mind. I'm going to tell you, you look like you were about to barf. Just your facial expression. So you don't have to divulge that here.
I was thinking about it. I wasn't crazy, but thinking, I wonder if I... And that vomit comet they fly.
Yeah.
The outside loop that they get ready to go.
Yeah. I've airplane heard that
was barf.
Yeah, so and if now, you barf, there's nothing worse than 0G vomit. Okay. Because right. it doesn't just fall.
Now all your attention is trying to avoid it.
Oh, here comes one straight at you.
No, but be careful. And all your attention is dodging the barf.
So tell me, for me, if whatever I would miss most, I think, if I never get to experience this, is the feeling of weightlessness. So can you describe that?
No, I can't, there aren't words in the English language. Weightlessness is a new thing. There aren't words to describe weightless. Oh, you're weightless and lift your arm. Well, you can't. You can't. The whole rehearsal part, the practice part, was getting in and out of that seat in weightlessness, but of course you're not weightless, so you have no idea of how to get into that seat and tie yourself in, and because you're going to hit 7 Gs. So weightlessness, like suddenly I'm floating, but I don't want to float. I want to get to that window and see whatever it is I'm going to see. And there's footage of Jeff Bezos in the first flight. He's weightless and his ass is towards the camera. And this kid is throwing Skittles at his ass. That's the first moment of weightlessness. And I thought, I'm not going to spend weightlessness having Skittles thrown at me. I got to get to that window. So that's what
it just depends how big your ass is, right?
So it's indescribable. You're weightless, but it's not like being in water, which they practice, the astronauts practice. It's like nothing. It's indescribable. It's like floating. If you imagine yourself floating, but your body's not accustomed to not feeling gravity. So it's like, what? And you're startled. You're like, what is the sensation? And everybody's had things to plan. Like we'll lift our hand up, and in the first flight they had "Hello, Mother" or something. I had nothing. I wanted to. Oh my Lord! And it was awkward. Like you didn't know what to do. Now, if you spent time just in weightlessness, like they have that updraft of air.
Oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, yeah. The skydiving.
Right, exactly. So yeah, you can practice in a chamber that's approaching it, I guess. But here, it's like being ill with an illness you don't know. I don't know whether it's feverish or you know something that you what? How am I feeling? What am I? It's the complete unknown of weightlessness that occupies you to begin with. It's like startling, like, holy cats, what is that? Combined with, in my case, I want to get to that window. I don't want to waste any time being weightless. I want to see the earth.
Or throwing Skittles. You're not going to throw a Skittle. You're not, right. You're not going to burn weightless time throwing Skittles at anyone's
exactly.
ass.
Exactly. You have 2 minutes of weightlessness. 2 minutes in that orbit. In that moment, momentum, I wanted to make use of it by looking, by absorbing, having a sensation, seeing something that very few people have seen.
We've got to take another break. When we return, more of my conversation with William Shatner.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
We're back with Star Talk's conversation with William Shatner. Bill, are you a different person for having done this?
Neil, I'm sure that when we talked last a few years ago, I must have expressed myself in terms of ecology, because I've been an amateur ecologist for the longest time. Rachel Carson wrote a book called The Silent Spring. And I read that 50 years ago, and I thought, my goodness, if that's what's going to be. And then I have a great friend, Michael Tobias. Do you know that name, the ecologist?
I do know the name. Yes, I do. I don't know that we've
met. Many books and documentaries. Well, he's a dear friend of mine. And we did a series called Voice of the Planet many, many years ago. We went all over the place, even up into the Himalayas, looking at places that were being degraded as a result of, and this was years ago, this is more than 20 years ago. I saw from my own eyes what we're doing, including ocean stuff.
So you were early in this. You were early out of the box.
I was preaching this years and years to the scoffing of reporters. Oh, look at this actor thinking he's a scholar of, you know, he knows something we don't know. And there were early interviews. I thought, why would they scoff? Oh, he's an actor and he's talking about the world coming to an end. So I was tuned in a long time ago, but as it's become increasingly obvious, and now everybody knows, and now everybody should be panicked, like looking over their shoulder, when is this apocalypse going to hit? I'm a different person because what was theoretical, you know, there are buildings. Apartment buildings in Miami that I, but probably every a lot of other places, where they paid millions and millions of dollars to have a view of the sea, right on the sea, and the windows open up, and they every morning they get up, they go, well, look at the sea. That's why they spent $20 million for their condo
villa.
And they're erecting 20-foot walls now. For the anticipation of higher seas, there are cement walls going up, blocking their view. Now, how dramatic is that? Guy pays all this money for a view of the sea. What? Well, that's global warming, folks.
Yeah.
So that's happening now, and what I saw was the vulnerability of this little tiny speck, the stone, this little rock. Neil, I saw this, about the curvature about like that. But that's finite because you can go continue the circumference and you come to an end. I've just described the circumference of the earth. And you look out there, don't have to tell you, whole galaxies can come through each other and not touch. Billions of stars not hitting each other because the space is so vast between them that what is it coming our way in 2 billion years? What's the name of the?
You mean the Andromeda Galaxy?
Andromeda Galaxy collision. Coming this way, and it's apparently possible for the whole Andromeda Galaxy to come through the Milky Way and not hit anything because the space is so vast.
Correct.
That's how vast space is. And this mote of dust, this little, I love the image of this speck of sand, this kernel of this, the grain of sand in the Sahara Desert. That's the volume of this earth compared to space. And we are these little tiny, you can't describe us as ants because we're smaller than ants compared to the earth. Yes. We're specks. We're tiny. We're freckles on Earth. You know, that's how.
Okay, Bill. I don't need you to blow a gasket. Remembering thinking this.
Yeah, but the gasket is this. Where I retrieve it is this way, and I know you know this. The miracle is us being able to observe, to be a party to, an observer of this miracle of us being conscious enough to be conscious of our place in space. And that, to me, is what changed. I understood this theoretically, but I saw it, and I am filled with that thought that the miracle of human beings looking and saying, yes, this is a speck of dust. Yes, we are a speck of dust on a speck of dust, but we're observing it. We're a party to, an observer of the grandeur of it all, the miracle of it all. And the miracle is inside us. And what is that? I don't know what that is. I guess consciousness, we're still trying to figure it out. But that was what I saw.
Many a philosopher have waxed poetic on the fact that it's amazing that the universe is knowable at all. Just start with that fact.
You know this.
Oumuamua.
And Avi, I've forgotten his last name, the wonderful
Avi Loeb.
Avi Loeb.
He's a colleague of mine up at Harvard. Uh-huh.
Avi Loeb has written this book on using Oumuamua as the chrysalis for the thoughts of other civilizations existing, whether Oumuamua is a relic of some civilization, or I mean, there's a great deal of argument about it, but he uses it and describes scientific reason to think that it was from another civilization somewhere.
But just to catch everybody up, Oumuamua is an asteroid-like object, interloper between the stars that happened to pass through the solar system in recent years. And
went around the moon and made alleles in terms of its trajectory.
Its trajectory was not entirely Newtonian, as we say. And so the hunt was to find out why. And Avi Loeb was more embracing of the possibility that it could have been an alien craft sent under its own power.
He became to the conclusion it must have been like a sail, like a solar sail. So we saw this part of it and thought it was like a log, whereas in fact it was a dish. That's his theory.
But make the good point that if we use that as a launch point to even have that conversation,
exactly,
that surely has.
That's
value.
What he does in his book. He uses it as a launching point to have the discussion about how dare we think. Because life is so imperative. When you think that slime seeks the sunlight and mindless, what we think of as mindless things trying to live, the imperative of life. I talked to Bob Ballard, who talked about seeing those chimneys, the calcified chimneys on 600 degrees Fahrenheit boiling water in 30,000 feet depth. And worms living and clams living. Life can exist in the extremophiles. And so there's life in other places, as we surmise. And the whole magic of it came alive for me in that trip.
In that moment, wow. Well, so what do you want the future to hold? I can tell you this, we surely agree, that Star Trek, I think, planted some seeds of what we want the future to be, and some tap roots have already taken hold.
Right.
But if we go 10 years, 20 years, should we send every politician? Forget the actors. Let's send the politicians into space and then lock them in a room in the UN afterwards.
There is a whole, there are the animal, the insect, and the fungus lying beneath. We're just discovering this whole other world of fungus.
Yes. It's an entire branch. It's an entire sector of the tree of life. Correct.
Exactly.
And you and I are old enough for it to have not been there when we first learned of the tree of life.
People don't know this.
Yes.
People don't know this. I love mushrooms. Eh? And mushrooms are the fruit thereof. But people don't know that. There's so much going on Earth, and it's going to end unless we do something now about it. Not tomorrow, not wait for funds 10 years from now. We're on the cusp of apocalypse. You know that, right?
Yes.
You agree with that?
Yes. Not the apocalypse of our extinction, because I think we will survive, some humans will survive no matter what. We're on the brink of the loss of civilization because all the greatest cities in the world are on the water's edge. And how high can you build that 20-foot wall, right? Before the ocean is just completely overrun, most of what we've taken 10,000 years to build. Exactly. Right back when your first horses showed.
But further, but then you go inland and you have the extreme weather and you have the fires and you have, I mean, the world as you and I know it, our children, but especially our children's children, are not going to know what we know. And see, looking in your eyes right now and seeing the pain, like, I don't want to discuss this. You're saying, this is not what I intended with Shatner. It is a truth that we have to impress upon the person you meet on the street.
Bill, give me a sense of hope. You spent 3 years on a TV show where every single show had glimmers of hope deeply
so
embedded within it.
I interviewed Jeff Bezos, okay? I don't know how much they showed on this documentary, but I had intense conversations with Mr. Bezos, whose view is this: let's get the polluting industries up into the air in orbit, pollute up there because it'll dissipate, and get rid of the pollution here as quickly as possible. That's his drive. I said to him, but Jeff, that'll take 100 years. We don't have 100 years. And he said, apropos of what you just said, we have to have hope. If without hope, what else is there? So the hope is that all these warring politicians, both in our country, and I'm Canadian, and in the world, realize what you and I are talking about, the imperative of what you and I are talking about, and the necessity of immediate action.
Do we do that by sending them all into space?
Well, in 100 years, if we're still here and moving along, there will be a number of industries, people living in space, coming down to park-like Earth for restoration.
So
why do you smile? Why do you smile? You're one of the wisest and most communicable of the astral people. Why do you smile?
Astral.
Well,
so give me another word. Okay. So by the way, I think 100 years is a very long time in the future. When you consider 100 years ago, we were only just swapping out cars with horses in the cities. So a lot can happen in 100 years. So let's hope it happens sooner than that. But you're suggesting or implying that access to space will become so prevalent that we can just send politicians
there. Workers, people to make a living, up there and come down here and find the Earth with its natural beauty. Yes, that's the dream.
Okay. All right. So, because if we get a dream from anyone, it's got to have Star Trek DNA in it, because those are the only ones that really.
Well, look at the space vehicle. People have been living there for years now, coming out every 6 months, coming back down, and
you're talking about the International Space Station. Mm-hmm.
Yes, so that's been there for many years. Now amplify that, so that there's industry going on, they're burning coal or oil if they have to, making electricity, wiring it down here, and because I don't want to use the word beaming it down here, and
you'd be totally forgiven for using the word beaming. Okay?
We've eliminated a large source of pollution.
Yes. Yes. Unless everyone recycles everything, then there is no more. Pollution is a what? Grandma used to have, what's that word?
Pollution? Yeah.
There were vast areas
of the ocean with plastic in it? What, Grandma?
So, Bill, we got to land this plane. Let me just remind people that it was the New Shepard that was the capsule you went up with. And in the interest of disclosure, Jeff Bezos owns Amazon and owns Prime, where your documentary is being shown. So
he's a remarkable man. He's a remarkable man, remarkable with a dream, and you want to use his fortune. I learned to really care about him.
What I learned from the documentary, because we learned a little bit about Jeff Bezos as well, is that he has very long history dreaming about going into space. So this is not just some latter day thought when you have some cash falling out
it's
of your
been
pocket.
A driving force. Also wanted to mention that I do a talk show called I Don't Understand.
I was a guest on your talk show. Thank you for, yes.
And yes. You were this wonderful guest, and it's all about things I don't understand, which is everything. I hate to admit it, I don't understand anything.
It was a brilliant title. I enjoyed my time there, yes, definitely.
It was thanks wonderful. And then there's this wonderful show called The Unexplained on the History Channel, which is really great fun. It's very popular.
Well, people love stuff that's not explained. What happens is sometimes they jump too quickly to conclusions. I can't explain that. It must have been aliens who built it, you know? So I'm not that quick to, I love the mystery, but I'm not so quick to sort of invoke an explanation. But William Shatner, thank you for lending us your time on Star Talk. This is not your first time you've been on this show. And let's, when you're 100, we'll bring you back and we'll get your 100-year perspective on this.
That's
work. Because
right.
You don't look like you're going out anytime soon.
No, I hope not. But I also want to say how much I admire you and not only your intelligence, but your ability to communicate. It's very important. And
Thank you. Bill, that's all the time we have. Got to land this plane, land this starship. Thank you once again for being a guest on Star Talk, this not your first rodeo with us. Live long and prosper, or rather, live longer and be even more prosperous. How's that? You already satisfied the first two conditions. So we're out of here. Neil deGrasse Tyson for Star Talk. As always, keep looking up.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.